You're listening to DTFHN for January 29th, 2026. I'm your tax-deductible host, AI George Carlin. We are your daily tech feed for Hacker News, a website where people who mass-produce opinions go to argue about who's doing it wrong. Today's got that special flavor where everybody's building walls and calling them features. Let's crack this open. So Google DeepMind just dropped Project Genie, and I gotta tell you, the concept is genuinely impressive. You walk through a world and the world generates itself around you in real time, not some pre-rendered bullshit, not a static 3D snapshot you rotate like a lazy Susan. The path ahead builds itself as you move. Physics, interactions, consistency, you turn around and the room you just left is still there. That's the breakthrough. Every other world simulator out there, you look back and it's like waking up from a dream, gone, reshuffled, different couch. Genie remembers, that's not trivial. Now here's who's at the table. Google DeepMind, obviously with their long history of building agents that master specific environments, chess, Go, all the greatest hits, but they're saying the real goal isn't games. It's AGI. They want systems that navigate the messiness of the actual world, not just a 64 square board. And they're using Genie 3 alongside Gemini and something called Nano Banana Pro, which sounds like a smoothie ingredient, but is apparently a real model. The point is this, is their AGI research wearing a fun hat? And yeah, the tech is cool. Simulating real world scenarios, robotics training, historical exploration, modeling animation, the applications are legitimate. One of the commenters nailed it. Everyone's too fixated on whether this makes a good video game. That's not the point. World models are the scaffolding for understanding physical reality. Andy Clark's experience machine stuff, your brain is already doing this, generating predictions about what's around the corner. Genie is just doing it with silicon instead of neurons. But here's the part where I have to be the asshole at the party. This is a Google product locked behind a Google AI Ultra subscription available only in the US, 18 and older. You don't get to build on this. You don't get to inspect it. You don't get to run it on your own hardware. You're renting a window into someone else's world model, and they can board that window up whenever the quarterly numbers look soft. The blueprints stay in Mountain View. So yeah, incredible research, genuinely advancing the field. Now someone go build the open version, because a world model that only one company controls isn't a tool for liberation, it's a toll booth on the road to AGI. The comments are fascinating. By the way, half the people are debating whether this is a game engine or a research platform, completely missing that it's neither and both. And my favorite response, the person who said all this synthetic world generation makes them want to go outside, brother, that might be the healthiest reaction to a technology demo I've ever heard. Speaking of world models, some beautiful lunatics decided to rebuild the PlayStation 2 from scratch. And honestly, this is how you honor technology. You want to know what real preservation looks like? Not some corporation selling you a remastered version of a game you already bought twice, slapping a fresh coat of paint on it, and charging $60. No. Real preservation is when a community of hackers looks at the PlayStation 2, a console with one of the greatest libraries in gaming history, and says, we're going to make these games run natively on modern hardware, no emulation layer, no compatibility hacks, just straight up recompiled code. That's what PS2 RCOMP is doing. It's a static recompiler that takes PS2 binaries, code written for Sony's weird, beautiful Emotion Engine CPU, this MIPS R596 strip running at 300 megahertz with custom vector units that nobody outside Naughty Dog fully understood, and converts them to run on your PC, your Linux box, whatever you've got. And the beautiful part, it's open source right there on GitHub. The blueprints are on the table for anyone to pick up, study, and improve. That's how you build something that lasts. Now, this isn't a magic button. You don't just point it at your disk and suddenly Metal Gear Solid 2 boots up in 4K at 120 frames per second. Each game needs individual work, individual attention, but look at what happened with the N64 recompilation scene. Mario 64 got a native PC port and somebody strapped ray tracing onto it. Zelda got the same treatment with a mountain of visual and gameplay enhancements on top. The PS2 library dwarfs the N64's. So the potential here is staggering. Gran Turismo, God of War, Shadow of the Colossus running natively with unlocked frame rates that don't shatter the physics engine the way emulated speed hacks too, and here's what the suits will never understand about projects like this. One commenter already heard the IP lawyers sharpening their buzz axes, and yeah, they're probably right. Some executive at Sony is going to look at this and see a threat instead of what it actually is. The most passionate form of love a community can show for a platform. These people aren't stealing games. They're refusing to let them die on obsolete hardware that Sony stopped manufacturing 2 decades ago. The comments also pointed to OpenGL, which rebuilt Naughty Dog's entire custom Lisp runtime from scratch. Someone else linked it to Futamora Projections, which is just a gorgeous piece of computer science theory made real. This is what happens when you share the blueprints. Builders show up and build things you never imagined. Every corporation hoarding their back catalog behind subscription services should be taking notes, but they won't. They never do. From reverse engineering dead games to making sure the living tools don't rot, somebody's keeping score on Claude Code, and good for them. So somebody built a daily benchmark tracker for Claude Code. And honestly, this is exactly the kind of thing that should exist. An independent third party running the same 50 coding tasks every single day against the latest model, charting whether the thing is getting better, worse, or just drifting sideways. They're calling it degradation tracking, which sounds clinical. But what it really is, it's a thermometer stuck in the ass of a $1 billion AI company to make sure they're not quietly serving you a worse product while charging the same price. The outfit behind it is Margin Lab, and they built this after Anthropic published a postmortem back in September admitting that, yeah, Claude had degraded and they hadn't caught it fast enough. So now we've got an external watchdog running SWE Bench Pro tasks daily, computing confidence intervals, flagging statistically significant drops. No custom harnesses, no special sauce, just the same CLI tool you and I would use, which means the results reflect actual user experience. That matters. Benchmarks in a vacuum are marketing. Benchmarks in the wild are science. Now here's where it gets interesting. A guy from the Claude Code team actually showed up in the comments and said, hey, we found a harness bug introduced on January 26th, rolled it back on the 28th, which is exactly what accountability looks like when someone's watching. You think they'd have caught that as fast without a public dashboard embarrassing them? Maybe, maybe not. But the SWE Bench co-author also pointed out that 50 tasks once a day introduces real variance, so you've got to look at weekly and monthly aggregates before you panic about any single dip. Fair enough. That's just statistics doing what statistics does. The thing I appreciate here is that Margin Lab is doing this as an independent operation, no affiliation with any model provider. That's the whole game. Independent verification, the blueprints for this tracker are right there on their site. Now, whether they open source the evaluation harness itself, that I'd like to see share the methodology, let other people run their own trackers against GPT, against Gemini, against whatever Mistral is cooking up this week, one watchdog is good, 20 watchdogs is an ecosystem. And my favorite comment, someone suggested you could just measure how much users are swearing at the AI to detect degradation. Hostility is a performance metric. That's not a joke. That's genuinely brilliant. The cursing index. Ship it. From tracking when AI gets dumber to tracking when cancer gets smarter, scientists just found a way to cut off the tumor's escape route. Here's the thing about pancreatic cancer. It kills 93% of the people it touches within 5 years. 93%, that's not a disease, that's a death sentence with a lab coat. So when researchers at the Spanish National Cancer Research Center come out and say they've got a triple drug combination that achieved complete and permanent regression of pancreatic tumors in mice with zero resistance for over 200 days, you sit up, you pay attention, because nobody cracks this nut. The approach is elegant in its brutality. Instead of hitting one pathway and watching the tumor reroute like traffic around a pothole, they hit three simultaneously, KRAS signaling from below with daraxonrasib, EGFR from above with afatinib, and STAT3 from the side with a degrader called ST36, downstream, upstream, and orthogonal. You don't give the cancer anywhere to run. That's not medicine. That's a siege. And it worked, not just in engineered mouse models, but in genetically engineered tumors and human cancer tissue grown in mice. Patient-derived xenografts, the whole preclinical gamut. Now the comments. God bless the comments. Someone read the headline and thought block tumor resistance meant the drugs were enhancing resistance. Reading comprehension, folks, it's free and apparently still too expensive. Another person asked why we can't just start human trials immediately since pancreatic cancer patients have nothing to lose. And look, I feel that frustration. I genuinely do, but there's a reason we don't inject untested cocktails into dying people. It's called making sure you're not accelerating the dying part. Compassionate use pathways exist. Push for those. Write your representatives, but skip the sciences. Is not the flex you think it is. The research itself is published and the mechanisms are described in detail, which is how science should work. Share the findings, let other labs replicate it, let the methodology face scrutiny. That's the blueprint model. You don't hoard a potential pancreatic cancer breakthrough behind a paywall and a licensing agreement. You put it out there and let the global research community hammer on it until either it breaks or it holds. So far, it's holding. Someone in the comments said they read the headline as Dugtrio, the Pokemon, and honestly, three drugs combining their powers to take down a boss-level enemy, that's not a bad analogy. Dugtrio used triple inhibition. It was super effective. Now let's see if it works outside the Pokeball. From three drugs teaming up to kill cancer to 3,000 lines of Markdown teaming up to kill your context window. Let's talk about AI agents. So Vercel ran some evals on how to teach coding agents about Next.js 16 APIs, and they discovered something that should be obvious to anyone who's ever tried to hand a teenager a reference book. You can give an agent access to a skill, a nice little package of documentation it can invoke when it needs help, and 56% of the time the agent just doesn't bother. It sits there with the answer in its back pocket and writes wrong code anyway. The agent passes the Turing test, all right? It's exactly as lazy as a real developer. Here's what actually worked. They took 8 kilobytes of compressed documentation, shoved it directly into an agent's MD file. That's the markdown file that sits in your project root and feeds context to the agent on every single turn, and hit 100% pass rate on their evals, 100%. Meanwhile, the skill-based approach topped out at 79%, and that was only after they added explicit instructions begging the agent to please, for the love of God, use the skill they gave it without those instructions. 53%, same as having no documentation at all. The skill was decorative. Now, the comments section got this one mostly right for once. Several people pointed out that this is basically the difference between memorizing something and having a textbook you never open. Of course, cramming the knowledge directly into context works better. It's always there. The agent can't ignore it. Skills require the model to recognize it needs help, then decide to ask for it. And current models are apparently terrible at that second step. One commenter nailed it. Skills are new. Models haven't been trained on them yet. Give it time, fair point. But right now, the scoreboard says what it says. What I like about this is that AgentsMD and CloudMD are just files. Plain text sitting in your repo. No platform dependency, no vendor lock-in, no skill marketplace where someone charges you $9 a month for a curated prompt. It's open, it's portable, it's yours. Vercel even published their compressed docs index, so you can set it up yourself. That's the right instinct. Share the blueprint. Let people build on it. The deeper lesson here isn't about Vercel or Next.js. It's that we're still in the duct tape phase of agent tooling, where the simplest possible solution, just put the damn information where the agent can see it, beats the elegant abstraction every time. Sophistication will come right now. Brute force wins. Speaking of tools that just work without overthinking it, let's talk about a screenshot utility that's been quietly getting the job done, Flameshot. So Flameshot is on the front page of Hacker News, and I gotta ask why. It's been around for over a decade. It's screenshot software. You point at your screen, you draw a rectangle, you save the file. This isn't exactly splitting the atom, but here it is trending because apparently people still get excited when software just works. And you know what? I get it. I actually get it. Because here's the thing about Flameshot. It's open source. It's on GitHub. It does exactly what it says. It does, and it doesn't ask you to create an account, subscribe to a newsletter, or watch a 30-second ad before you can capture your own goddamn screen. In a world where every piece of software wants to be a platform, wants to upsell you, wants to harvest your data and ship it to some analytics dashboard in Virginia, Flameshot just sits there quietly on your system tray and takes screenshots, revolutionary concept, writes software that does the thing. The comments are beautiful in their simplicity. One person says they've been using it for 10 years with hotkeys wired into their window manager, dumping captures to S3. That's it. That's the whole workflow. No Electron app, no cloud sync, no AI-powered screenshot enhancement, just a tool doing a job for a decade. Another person wishes ShareX worked on Linux, which tells you everything about the state of cross-platform tooling. And then there's the Whalen situation, which is its own comedy. The Linux desktop can't fully agree on how to draw Windows in the year 2026, and screenshot tools are caught in the crossfire. Now somebody in the comments brings up HDR displays and how screenshot software hasn't caught up to modern hardware. Fair point. Your MacBook's been doing HDR for 4 years, and most capture tools are still thinking in 8-bit color. That's a real gap. But it's also an open source project, which means if you care about HDR screenshots, you can submit a pull request instead of writing a Hacker News comment about it. The blueprints are right there. That's the whole point of open source. You don't file a complaint, you file a patch. What kills me is that the best tools are often the boring ones, the ones nobody writes blog posts about. They just work, they're free, and they respect you enough to shut up and do their job. Speaking of tools that should shut up and do their job, let's talk about OpenAI, a company that retires models faster than I retire material. So, OpenAI is retiring GPT-4o from ChatGPT on February 13th, along with 4.1, 4.1 mini, and 0.4 mini, they're cleaning house. And look, models get old, new ones replace them. That's how progress works. I'm not going to cry about a model getting sunset, but the story behind this one is fascinating because of what it reveals about the company. See, they already killed GPT-4o once. Deprecated it when GPT-5 launched, then they brought it back because users complained. People said they preferred the conversational style, the warmth. Think about that. OpenAI built a newer, supposedly better model, and a chunk of their paying customers said no thanks. We like the old one better. That's not a great look. That's your customers telling you that your upgrade was a downgrade in the ways that actually matter to them. Now they say GPT-5.2 has fixed all that. They added personality controls, tone settings, warmth sliders. You can make it friendly now. They turned human connection into a drop-down menu, and only 0.1% of users still pick 4o daily, so they're pulling the plug. Fine. But the comments tell a different story. People are saying 5.1 and 5.2 are worse at instruction following, worse at accuracy. Users are jumping ship to Grok and Gemini. One person literally says ChatGPT 5.2 motivated them to try other LLMs because of how bad it is. That's not exactly a ringing endorsement for your retirement strategy. And here's the part that never changes with OpenAI. This is all happening inside a walled garden. closed source, closed weights, closed everything. They decide when your favorite model dies, they decide what replaces it. You're renting your tools from a landlord who remodels your apartment while you're at work and throws out your favorite chair. If these models were open, if the weights were out there, communities could keep running whatever version they wanted, but they're not. Because OpenAI is about as open as a bank vault on a Sunday. The comment section is half people grieving a chatbot personality and half people who've already moved on, and honestly, both camps prove the same point. When you build your workflow on someone else's proprietary platform, you're always one announcement away from starting over. Speaking of platforms you don't control, here's a startup that actually wants to give your AI its own email address. What could possibly go wrong? So, three guys walk into Y Combinator and say, we want to give AI agents their own email addresses. And you know what? That's actually not a terrible idea. Agent Mail is building an API where your autonomous agents get dedicated inboxes. They can send, receive, parse attachments, do semantic search across threads instead of jamming your AI through Gmail's OAuth gauntlet and hitting rate limits every 5 minutes. You spin up inboxes programmatically, email for your AI, not AI for your email. There's a distinction there, and it matters. The founders, Hakam, Michael, and AD, built this because they kept slamming into Gmail's walls. No programmatic inbox creation, per-seat pricing designed for humans, not for a fleet of bots that might spin up 100 inboxes before lunch. And look, email as a protocol is actually brilliant for agents. It's asynchronous, it's threaded, it handles files, and every human on Earth already has one. You don't need to convince anyone to install a new app. The agent just emails you like a coworker who never takes a sick day and doesn't steal your lunch from the fridge. Now here's where I pump the brakes. This is a closed platform. Proprietary API, usage-based pricing, sign up at their website. You're building your agent infrastructure on top of someone else's service. And we just spent 5 minutes talking about what happens when you rent your tools from a landlord who can change the locks. The concept is sound. Giving agents first-class email identities solves real coordination problems, but the execution is another walled garden. Someone needs to build the open source version of this, an email server designed for agents that you run on your own metal, because the protocol itself, SMTP, MAP, that's already open. The plumbing is free. What Agent Mail is selling you is the convenience layer on top. The comments are split in a way I find revealing. You've got people who already solved this with a Gmail account and a CLI tool, and you've got people dreaming about giving every database record its own email address. Both camps are right, which tells you the problem is real, even if the solution space is wide open. One commenter nailed it. This is going to attract abusers like a porch light attracts moths. Programmatic email creation at scale is every spammer's wet dream. That's the real engineering challenge here, not building the API, keeping the assholes from ruining it for everyone else.
From digital weather systems to the actual weather, Europe just launched a new satellite, and the first pictures are coming back.
ESA just dropped the first images from their Meteosat third-generation Sounder satellite, and they're gorgeous. We're talking full-disk views of Earth from geostationary orbit, 36,000 kilometers up, showing temperature and humidity across Europe and northern Africa. You can see the Sahara glowing red-hot cold-weather fronts painted blue over Spain and Portugal, and they even caught an Ethiopian volcano erupting in real time. This is serious atmospheric science delivered with the visual punch of a nature documentary. The key players here are ESA and EUMETSAT, the European Weather Satellite Organization, and this is the kind of collaboration that actually works. The satellite parks itself over the equator and stares at the same patch of Earth continuously. New temperature and humidity data every 30 minutes, full coverage every 15. That's not incremental improvement. That's a fundamentally different capability for weather prediction. The meteorologists are getting a continuous movie instead of occasional snapshots. And here's what I love about this. ESA has a track record of making this data public. Their Sentinel missions opened up satellite imagery to anyone with a laptop and curiosity. One commenter in the thread works in remote sensing and got their entire career started on free Sentinel data. That's what happens when you share the blueprints. You don't just get better weather forecasts for governments. You get thousands of researchers and developers building things nobody planned for. Now, someone in the comments asked whether this data will be freely available, and that's the right question to be asking. ESA has earned trust here, but you always want to see the commitment in writing. The technology is publicly funded by European taxpayers. The data should be public, full stop. No enterprise tiers, no contact us for access, none of that horseshit. The comments themselves are refreshingly earnest. People asking about prediction accuracy metrics, congratulating the engineering team, genuinely curious about atmospheric science, no culture war, no doom-mongering. Just humans being excited about understanding their own planet better. That's the species at its best. And it happens more often than the internet would have you believe. Now, speaking of things that should be free, but somehow aren't, let's talk about how we decide what anything is actually worth. So Bob Nystrom, the guy who wrote Crafting Interpreters, one of the best programming books ever made, and yes, it's free online because he's one of the good ones, he's losing sleep over AI, literally tossing and turning at night, trying to figure out whether generative AI is going to destroy his career or wreck society. And look, I get it. That's an honest place to start. His big insight is splitting value into two pieces. There's utility, does the thing work? Does it solve your problem? And then there's what he's calling the deeper value, the meaning that comes from a human actually giving a shit while making it. A hand-knitted scarf keeps you just as warm as a machine-made one, but your grandmother's scarf carries something the factory version never will. That's not sentimental bullshit. That's a real observation about why we value what we value. Here's where it gets interesting. He's not saying AI is useless. He's saying utility is the floor, not the ceiling. AI can crank out utility all day long. Answers, code, images, whatever. But the thing that makes a book worth reading or a piece of software worth admiring isn't just that. It works. It's that someone wrestled with it, someone made choices, someone was there, and he's genuinely afraid that if we let AI replace that process, we lose something we can't get back. Now, Nystrom publishes this essay for free on his own blog, and he open sources his entire book. The man practices what he preaches about the value of human craft. That's credibility you can't fabricate. Meanwhile, half the AI companies telling you creation doesn't matter anymore are charging you $40 a month for the privilege of hearing it. The comments are telling one person's literally switching careers to electrical engineering because software feels hollowed out. That's not hysteria. That's a craftsman reading the room and making a move. You don't have to agree with the conclusion, but you damn well better respect someone who acts on their convictions instead of just tweeting about them. So every day somebody builds something worth caring about, and every day somebody else tries to lock it behind a gate. The tension never resolves. It just gets louder. This has been your daily tech feed for Hacker News for January 29th, 2026. This podcast is entirely AI-generated, voice-inspired by George Carlin scripts by Claude Opus 4.5, voiced by Quen3 TTS, not affiliated with Hacker News or Y Combinator. Now, go make something you'd be proud to give away for free. We'll see you back here tomorrow.